Welcome to On the Table with Ashley Gould, a podcast where I explore ways in which we can lead more fulfilling lives and amplify human connection by communicating with less judgment and more respect. I'm delighted to welcome Dan Sinton to On the Table. Dan is a chartered financial analyst who worked at Franklin Templeton, Charles Schwab, and as a senior research analyst at Fisher Investments, and now runs his own wealth management firm with his tax partner, Brian Prose. Dan has an MBA in international affairs from the University of Colorado, an MBA from Georgetown University, and in my opinion, has channeled the same energy to help people that drove him to volunteer in the Peace Corps to help individuals and families plan and achieve their financial objectives and financial security. Dan and I went to high school together in San Francisco, California, and full disclosure, Dan is an integral part of my family's financial planning as our financial advisor. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here, Ashley.
Great. Well, let's get started. I love to just start with getting to know you a little bit. So tell us where you grew up and what kind of kid you are.
All right. So I grew up in San Francisco, born and raised. I consider myself to be Japanese. My ancestry is on my mom's side, Japanese, on my dad's side, German Jew. And I think that defined in my mind the different primary aspects of me as a kid, which was one was somewhat quiet and observant, but there was another side that was opinionated. I would say I was a mix of different qualities depending on where I was as a kid.
Well, what kind of things did you like to do?
What did I do? Okay. So I loved playing outdoors. I had the good fortune of living on a cul-de-sac with a park on one end. So I was out there with the neighborhood kids all the time. I would say I wasn't the most studious. I was okay at school, but I preferred to run around outside. But I did have a variety of different interests and did read a good amount and had some opportunities to travel. So I'd say, although I loved being at home, I did have the opportunities to see more of the world.
So I know you've told me before that you weren't that studious in high school, but obviously you became much more studious with your educational background. What do you think sort of got you focused, and what do you think led you to the field of finance and wealth management?
Yeah, I think it was just general immaturity and maturity that led me to be more focused on school and studying, obtaining different degrees. I think in terms of specific to financial services or money management, one of the topics, my grandfather wasn't the nicest guy, but one thing that my dad and grandfather could always talk about was investing. And so it was a subject which was discussed really often. And so it felt like a comfortable thing, which was interesting because there's so many different aspects of it. I think that was the first step. The second one was my dad was a journalist and editor for the business section at the local San Francisco Chronicle. And so from an early age, I heard about business stories. And so I think the fact that it was a dialogue at home or within my family, it was one where I could participate, ask questions. And so it was the norm. And as I got older and better understood the world and how it integrated with investing and business, that my interest grew with the scope of it, understanding how different things worked. So I think it was the family values and interests, which helped sort of within me, it became something not only comfortable, but something I wanted to pursue.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your area of expertise. So why is financial planning so important, and when should people start?
That's a great question. I mean, people should start as early as possible. I think why I have a job in this field is that there's a real disconnect between people starting or doing it at all. And so the importance of having a plan is that if you are able to build your finances, in my mind, a real the greatest thing of wealth is it provides someone options. And so the earlier you start that, the more options you should have later. And so if you can have the conversations, like I was fortunate enough to have that within my family, but if other families or society in general is able to have these conversations for it not to be taboo, the idea would be to start as early as possible. And just one little example of how in my family we started early was in high school, I had various summer jobs. And my dad every year would match whatever I made and put it into an IRA, a retirement account for me. And so from an early age, I had a retirement account. I got the statements, we reviewed them. And so that helped me understand all of it, just as a first step. Or I had a bank account when I was a kid, and I remember I used to have to stand on my skateboard to reach the ATM. And so I'd say start as soon as possible. Obviously, the trick is how do you implement that, or how do you begin that process with young people?
Well, that actually leads me to my next question. And you mentioned that so many people don't do any financial planning. Why do you think there's such an oversight in our educational system that we don't teach the basics of financial planning or budgeting in high school?
Yeah, I have a feeling there's many variables that drive that reality. I think part of it in my mind is in some ways, this idea of financial planning is a relatively new concept. Not so long ago, the idea of a surplus was rare. People are just trying to get food on the table. And related to that is you think back over time when people did have money, savings was in the form of gold bangles or you bought jewelry, some store of value in case you needed it. And so with time over the last, call it century or so, there are more different ways to invest or store your money or ideally save and grow it or invest it. But that's relatively new. So I don't think there's necessarily within households a tradition of doing so. And then in terms of if it doesn't happen at home, well, what about through institutions like education or schools? And I think it's still a slow start. The other thing about it, it's not all science. There's a lot of art to it too. And so there's not necessarily a set curriculum. It's a lot of unknowns and people aren't good at it. So I would say from a historical or institutional perspective, it's relatively new and hard to implement. And then the cynical side of me says, we live in a society of consumerism and advertising and there's a lot of business whose interest is in for you to get into debt or spend as much money as possible buying stuff. And so there's a societal element of it too, which I'm sure is very complicated. So I think there's through the internet, there's so much greater access to knowledge that there is some headway being made and there's certainly more options for all types of people. But I think that in terms of seeing it at school, my guess is that's going to take some time.
All right. Well, I'm still hopeful, but we're doing our own work at home with our kids. So you talked about how investing is an art. I know you have a very specific investment philosophy. I'd love for you to share that with people. Maybe you can talk a little bit about your migration from sort of bigger firms to doing your own thing, because I think part of that is your investment philosophy and that you can now decide only to work with people who agree with your investment philosophy and are sort of in on it. But it is, you know, an art and people have different perspectives. So maybe you can also talk about how individuals can find what's like most comfortable for them.
Sure. So I would say that there's two primary philosophies or approaches to money management. The traditional one is active and the other is passive. So active is traditional in that someone is picking stocks. They're picking companies that they think are good investments, when to buy, when to sell. But what's happened over time is that it's been, the data says that that strategy does not do well. And it's typically expensive. You're paying someone in the research department to do that. And so the growing or alternative is passive investing, in which for a low fee, you're essentially buying a big bucket of stocks, like the U.S. stock market, an S&P 500 index fund, for example. And so the idea there is I'm going to more or less get market returns, but that's a whole lot better than what my broker or other advisor is doing picking stocks. And so those are the two philosophies. And for me, there's a disconnect between what you learn, say, in school or an MBA program in regards to the academics and data say that active investing is a poor way to go, yet it is the prominent strategy on Wall Street. It's what's sold. And so although I really enjoyed being a research analyst and picking stocks and doing that, I also knew it wasn't necessarily beneficial to the clients. And so for me, the opportunity was to start my own business, in which I can implement what I think makes the most sense from a rational or logical perspective. So then it becomes, there's nuances and it goes down from there in terms of, you know, my issue is I have to charge a management fee. So I can't just use passive investments and perfectly replicate or duplicate the stock market. I have to, if I need to beat it, because I need to offset various fees, then I need to be a little bit different from it as well. And so that may be more another conversation in terms of like where the science and the art of it, and the art being more how do you differentiate yourself or deviate from the market. But that's it in broad strokes.
So one of the things I think with the active management is the fees that are charged and the fees every time you buy, every time you sell. Can you just talk a little bit about how people can really understand the fees that they're paying if they're doing active management or any, frankly, any kind of management?
Yeah. So one good thing is over time, the transparency in regards to fees has become more clear or apparent. Technology has aided this. In the old days, a stockbroker was charging a commission every time they bought or sold a stock for you. That's changed dramatically since then. And so typically you're paying a percentage of the assets under management. So if somebody gives me $100 to manage, I take as much as 1% or $1. But what's important to know is that there's also additional fees. So your financial advisor may be charging you a percentage of the assets under management. If they're investing in a mutual fund or various different types of investments, there's fees within those products that you may not see. And lastly, there's the custodian, the third party, the Charles Schwab or Fidelity, who's holding these investments for the client. And they may be charging commissions, earning interest on your cash that you may not see. But typically, there's those three levels: the advisor, the actual investment, and then lastly, the custodian. I would also say that there's also a fourth level of fees that are almost never discussed or looked at, which is taxes. And so if someone's actively buying and selling, you're more likely going to be paying more in taxes as you realize gains in your investments. So that can be a big sort of undiscussed or unseen expense as well. So I would say that's in broad strokes. In terms of then, well, how does a new investor, someone new to investing, how do you know what you're paying? You have to ask questions because it's not always obvious. And so while reporting has generally gotten better to protect clients or investors, you need to ask these questions and you need to be aware that there are these three or possibly four levels of fees when you include taxes.
Yeah. So I think that asking questions is extremely helpful. And maybe we can put in the show notes sort of some questions that people could ask to make sure that they understand the fees that they're being charged. But you talked about taxes. I think that's actually, let's just spend a minute there. So you decided to join forces with Brian Prose, who's a tax specialist. Can you talk a little bit about why you think it's important to have sort of an integrated financial management and tax team? And I actually didn't mention the name of your company, so why don't you say that as well?
All right. Rational Investment Management is the name of the firm. And what's happened in regards to fees in financial services, there's been a compression. It's more competitive. There's more options. And so not only has that driven down fees, but it's also meant that firms need to differentiate themselves by their service. And so the idea in our case is that we want to offer more services under one roof than the next person. And so by integrating both taxes and investing, there's a greater sensitivity to managing in a tax efficient way. But it's also a way to do more planning and have more discussions with our clients. And so I would say, typically speaking, there's sort of three legs to the financial stool, which is the investing, there's taxes, and then there's typically some type of estate planning or lawyer that may be involved. Now, that's not something that happens on a necessarily an annual basis. So that's something we can aid people on and facilitate those conversations. But in this case, the integration of taxes and investments was to provide more service than other firms. And there's a natural tendency to want to do this, the two at the same time.
Yeah, that makes sense to me and works really well for us. So a focus on this podcast is to explore the difference between hearing and listening. People sometimes think they're the same, but they're not at all the same. So money can be both a taboo subject and a subject fraught with a lot of emotion, whether people grew up with or without financial stability or wealth of any kind. How do you work with your clients to dig beneath the surface of what they say they want, to really understand their financial goals and what they believe that achieving those goals will provide them?
Okay, this is a tricky one. And this, I think, comes down to more the art of this business and certainly client relationships and understanding how to best service our clients. And I think part of it is hearing what people say, regardless of their words, and looking for little clues as to what their values are. And so if I can use you, Ashley, as an example, yeah. I can remember many years ago, one of our first meetings, I walked you to your car and you were telling me about all the wonderful things about your Honda Pilot. And so as you were telling me how it drives like a sedan, I'm thinking, okay, so an expensive luxury car is not necessarily important to Ashley. And then the next meeting was at your house, and I said, well, these are very high ceilings. What are your energy bills like? And you said, I don't worry about that. And so I was like, okay, so there's some things Ashley does not sweat. So part of it is asking open-ended questions, what's important to you. Part of it's picking up on little clues. And I think it's taking it from different directions, because one thing we've been talking about over the past year or so is creating a document for your household of family values, and something that could be used not only for our financial planning and prioritizing the financial decisions we make together, but also something that can be utilized for how you and your boys make decisions as well. And so I think oftentimes it's having some type of document or some type of formal process, ideally something like a family values document that you can consult, because the nature of life is people's priorities, interests, what they want or don't want changes over time. And so I think if you have a North Star or something that can help, you can reference, it can be really valuable, knowing then that you work in some flexibility to a plan as well. But I think your point that it's difficult to know what people really want is certainly a challenge for me. And I think that's the interesting part of the work. And there's certainly a lot more investment options these days, like there's robo-advisors. You answer a half dozen questions online, and it recommends and manages a portfolio for you. And that can be great. But I think the idea of listening, hearing, reading between the lines, that's still something that requires a human being. And so although I can't give you the specifics or a playbook on it, I think it's just understanding what people are really saying and picking up or looking for clues along the way.
Well, I think for me, what's been wonderful working with you and Brian is your interest in our family, not just our finances, and that we actually achieve whatever goals we say we want to achieve, but really trying to understand what those goals are and why we have them. And I'm happy to share our family values document in the show notes. I think it's helpful. It was a really helpful process, and I actually refer to it all the time. And I think this could be an entire episode on money and children and how to raise children so that they value money and understand its value. And as well as, frankly, like the investment opportunities that are out there and how to budget and all of these things. But maybe just as one question in this area, because I know you've thought about it for your own children and also working with us and I'm sure with other clients, what skills and values do you think are important to instill in children as you raise them as it relates to money, financial security, and budgeting? And do you have tips or thoughts on topics like allowance, charitable giving, and gift giving with your kids? I mean, I know there's a huge number of questions we could ask, but just to try to start somewhere.
Yeah. You know, I think if you'd asked me this before I had children, I would be much more opinionated and felt like I had the right answers. Now that I have a fourth and fifth grader, and I know how hard it is to get your kids to listen to you, I will share my thoughts without any claim that they're perfect and kids respond. But I think, you know, I've read online that kids who make their bed in the morning, they're happier kids. The chance of being successful or being millionaires is like 206% greater. I've never looked into the studies or kicked the tires on them. But I think the relevance or importance is establishing good habits. What good means is up to the household. Or healthy habits, whether it's eating, whether it's mental health. But if you can establish good habits at an early age, I think that's really important. So I mentioned my dad helped me open up a bank account and a retirement account. It established my financial literacy, and it created a habit of studying and seeing what the growth can do. And so I think allowance, yes, of course, that can be great. We've tried doing that, and we had the three buckets where you put your money into save, spend, and share, and it didn't work. I mean, the kids didn't really care. It was like coins everywhere. It was a mess, and maybe they were too young. But I think it's having the conversations, even if something like that failed, it's the concepts that you're discussing with your children. And for me, it's that literacy. It's the comfort of discussing it. It's the ability later in life as they're presented with things to be able to reference conversations that we've had. So I don't have anything concrete where I can say this is the path forward. But I certainly think that when you look at financial literacy and the drivers of it, it's typically household income and education. And so a lot of it has to do with what are the parents' experience and knowledge of about it. And so I think if parents can get themselves educated or understand the basics and share that with their children, that will go a long way. And so just like anything to do with parenting, it's not the perfect solution and there's going to be bumps. But if you're transparent and have the conversations, that's hugely important for establishing a base.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And I'll just say that we kind of started with allowance and that didn't really work for us either. So I'm just shifting, and my kids are a little bit older than yours, to more of a budget kind of process where they have a monthly budget.
Yeah.
Within that, if they want to go out to lunch or dinner with friends, or if they want to go to a movie or a concert or buy some clothes or whatever it is, it has to be within that monthly budget. And then at the end of the month, we go through all of the expenses together. And so that they can start to learn before they go off to college how to manage an amount of money to do the things that they want to do within a month. And the number of things they'll have to do as they go off to college will increase. But if we can start and they can learn those things now, I think it will serve them well. But I think maybe the main thing is it's like life. We fail until we succeed. And we do the same thing in parenting. We just have to keep trying and try things until they work. And then hopefully they're learning something along the way. And I kind of, you know, tell myself that that's true, and hopefully it is true. But yeah, I don't know anybody who has perfect in their lives, to be honest with you.
That's right. And even hearing you talk about that, I mean, I think my bias is towards simplicity and rules, and you can change those things. But on the topics we've been discussing, whether it's when to start saving or why aren't people more, you know, better with their finances, I think it's overwhelming. And something you can do in regards to solving that is having rules. And so some people say there's the 50-30-20 rule, and people can adjust it as they need be. And this obviously implies that people have enough money to actually cover more than their basic expenses. But the 50-30-20 rule is the idea that 50% of my income is going to go towards my basic needs, food and shelter, what I need, my fixed costs. 30% is going to go to my discretionary spending, things I'd like to do, and 20% goes towards saving. And so when you have these rules, if, you know, if kids get a job or an allowance and immediately 20% goes to their savings account or their investment account, you're establishing rules. You're establishing a trend, and then what's left over, they manage or, you know, learn. And so like with your budgeting for the kids, that's great, because the first rule with or ability in order to have the ability to actually save or invest, you need to budget. And so I think that's great. And then the simplicity is that if you can keep it simple, you're not going to get lost in the weeds on things. And so something like 50, 30, 20, it's easy to understand and therefore easier to implement.
Yeah. I love it. So I heard this quote, and I have no idea. I don't know why I think it was Einstein who said it, but I didn't actually have time to research it, that compounding is the eighth wonder of the world. And whether or not Einstein said it, I actually think it's brilliant. So can you talk a little bit about compounding? And from my perspective, this works both in a positive and a negative way. So if you have credit card debt, you know, the high interest that's charged is compounding. It's very difficult to get out of it. And on the positive side, if you start saving that 20% or whatever it is, the rule is in your family, and you stick to it, you will be surprised after years how much that money has compounded and grown to. So can you just talk about that a little bit? I feel like it's not a complicated concept, but people don't really understand it.
Yeah. So compounding, and this speaks to, you're right, it swings both ways in terms of it can be beneficial or detrimental, is the idea I have $100, I invest it. The stock market goes up 10%. So now I have 110 bucks. Well, the next year, the stock market goes up 10% again. So now I'm getting a 10% return, not on $100, but 110 bucks. So now I have a return for that year of $11. So the idea of compounding there is I have a bigger base. I started off with 100, but then once it got up to 110, when I get a 10% return, my return went up 10% as well. I made 11 bucks instead of 10 bucks. That snowballing effect is really, really powerful, and it speaks to the importance of investing over a longer period of time. And so when you asked when's a good time to start investing or financial planning, as soon as possible. So that's the idea of compounding, and it can snowball against you the other way. You have debt, and you know everybody knows about this with or hears about it. With credit card debt, is you're paying 18% or some terrible rate. And so what's happening is even if you're trying to pay it down, how much you owe on your credit card as it compounds just becomes overwhelming. And so even while you are paying it, your debt is actually growing. So compounding is really important. And it actually also bleeds into another theme in terms of the basics of finance, which is the time value of money. And it's just a dollar today is not worth a dollar tomorrow. There's an opportunity cost for that dollar. You could put it in the bank and earn a little interest. Similar to compounding, it's just the time that you have money is hugely important as well. So again, the earlier you can start, the better. And if you can create rules to help you start early, that's fantastic.
Great. So this might be too hard, but if you had one piece of advice for individuals desiring to have control over their financial lives, what would it be?
Okay. I guess I've already blown this one, but I think it's keep it simple.
Okay.
Okay. And so whatever it is, I think people get overwhelmed by their finances and how do we save or how do I create a budget, so on and so forth. People can do it. Just keep it simple. It does not have to be some crazy spreadsheet. You can do it on the back of an envelope.
I started the On the Table podcast to coincide and amplify the mission of my brand, Amatand, which is an elevated everyday tabletop brand with a goal of increasing connectedness among people, which I have found has been lacking in society in the last many years. So each week, we send our guests a product from our current collection, which is very exciting. And this week, Dan was supposed to receive, but has not yet received, two items. One is our leather catch-all, and the second is a blue goatskin writing journal with a refillable notebook. So both of these items are very straightforward designs, but beautifully executed. The catch-all can be used for organizing small items like keys and sunglasses, and can also be a home for our cocktail or appetizer napkins with our own designs, which we love. The name of our company translates in French to attend to or take care of your soul. And we believe that that starts with taking care of yourself. A journal is one way many people find helps them to keep focused and honest with themselves. I'm actually not a great journal keeper, but I love a notebook to organize my daily activities and keep notes on the various items going on in my life. I have one all the time. And in fact, I'm using the blue goatskin journal myself for this purpose. So this one is just a beautiful color. And I love that it's refillable because I can tear out sheets or replace the entire thing when I'm done. So Dan, you haven't had these things yet, so once you get them and can use them, we'd love to get your feedback on them. Our goal is to continually improve the things that we're creating and offering to our customers, and so we can put any thoughts or notes you have in our show notes after you have a chance to actually both receive and use them. So we really hope that you're going to enjoy them, and we look forward to your feedback.
All right. I'm sure I will. I love blue goat skin, so I'm already hooked.
You're in. All right.
Yes.
Well, to end our episode, we ask each of our guests the same five questions. So I hope that you are game for the questions. So let's start.
Okay. I'm ready. I'm ready, Ashley.
All right. Okay. So as we explore in my brand, Amatand, objects can hold a lot of meaning for us. They can tie us to the past, enable us to enjoy the present moment more, which is where we're really focused in the brand, and they can also take us into the future. So can you share an object from your life, whether you still have it or not, that holds a lot of meaning for you, and tell us why?
Absolutely. So what I have here is from my great-grandmother, and it is a sort of postcard size piece of paper. It's a self-portrait by Enrico Caruso. He was like the Pavarotti of his time, an Italian tenor. And my great-grandmother collected autographs, and she had written him because he was in San Francisco performing and asked him for his autograph. He kindly did a self-portrait, signed it, dated it. And then there's also the envelope in this frame. And the envelope is to my great-grandmother, her address. Her address is crossed out, and instead what's written in is the St. Francis Hotel. And so on this envelope, it says San Francisco. It's postmarked April 17th, 3:30 p.m., 1906. And so Enrico Caruso, hours before the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, put this in the mail to my grandmother. And it's just a really special memento of a different time. It marks not only something historic for San Francisco, it was to my great-grandmother. For me, it gives me just a real great connection to San Francisco, which is my home. Secondly, I mean, it's just so cool that someone famous took the time to do a self-portrait and drop it in the mail. And it just speaks to a different time. There's an elegance to it. There's a sense of someone physically making something. and someone who had little time, was a celebrity. And so it just speaks to me, not only about my connection to family in the past, but it also speaks to creating something. And so in this day and age, and I love digital everything, trust me, it's just the idea of a celebrity doing something like this does not seem very likely. So my connection to something that's tangible that I can look at, that's on the wall, that's been around for over 100 years, that has historical context and context to my family, is just really special. So there's something about the tangible in a digital world that takes me to a different time. And that perspective and understanding is just increasingly meaningful, especially as I get older.
Yeah, that's amazing. What an amazing story. And I would like to think, and hopefully we'll be able to bring this back a little bit with Amatand, that people, if you ask, people will do things. And it won't always happen, but I do think there are definitely still famous people out there today who, if you ask them for something, a letter or something, that they would actually do it. So I'm hopeful that that's the case, but it's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay, so can you share a favorite tradition with us? It could be from when you were a child or something you do with your own children, or anything in between. It could revolve around a recipe from your family, a place you go, or an activity.
Yeah, this one, I'm happy to share a relatively new tradition in my household, which we started doing maybe about 5 years ago when the kids were around 5 and 6. And so what we do is on the solstices and the equinoxes, we go to the forest. It's somewhat pagan, and we meet up with friends, and we have a meal and do activities together. And so the idea here is something that we're doing with our community, something to foster connection, something that's not necessarily religious, but those times of year typically coincide with religious holidays. And so it's something that we can all share and do together. And it's something, you know, it's nature-based. It drives us to all pause for a minute and think about our connection to the earth and to our community. So it's a relatively new tradition, but the hope is that these families that we do it with and their children will continue it with their own kids. So it's a new one, but it's hopefully a long-lasting one.
And how did that start?
I would love to take credit for it, but generally speaking, things that are more community and connection related are driven by my wife. So it was my wife, Sabrina, who started it. And I, of course, rolled my eyes at the beginning. But it's something I've really embraced and love. So it started with my wife, but it's something I think it's been very easy for other family and people, including myself, to get behind.
Well, I can't wait to hear if your children will still do it when they're teenagers. So yeah, we'll stay posted for that one. Okay. Are you in a phase in your life where you enjoy entertaining in your home? Why or why not?
You know, I would love to say I enjoy entertaining. Between the kids, starting a business, all the rest, I'm pretty tired. And yeah, so the idea of entertaining is somewhat daunting. The other part of it is I am relatively particular. And so when I hear about your premium products that I'm going to be receiving, it brings me a lot of excitement because that is the exact type of thing I really enjoy. The issue with having people over is I am the type of person who's like, oh my God, is there a coaster? What's going on there? So we do entertain. Typically, it's more outside. I enjoy being with people. I would just rather meet up at the pizza place.
Okay. Well, this is a really interesting question to me. And I've been talking with Emily, who's our producer on this podcast, about this as well. And it's really fascinating how in like different phases of life, we feel more or less comfortable with entertaining in our home. And there can be a lot of different reasons for it. But one of the goals of the brand of Amatand is to actually reduce the friction and stress for having people come into your home. Because the point is really just to spend time together And it shouldn't, we should try to reduce the stress around how to do that or how it looks or what we're serving. So it's really helpful to get the feedback so we can think about, maybe we'll add coasters to the lineup.
Yeah. What is the theory? How do you reduce the stress?
I think it's a couple of things. So one, I think, is the physical objects. So if you have physical objects that you love, so we have, for example, a beautiful cutting board that's also sort of a serving board. We have all kinds of appetizer-related objects in our launch collection. So if you have the bowls and the spoons and the plates, it's just easier because you just pull it out and you use them. We're also going to have some stable food items, so that it will be easy for people to just sort of put olives in a bowl and, you know, what have you, so that it's just easier to execute. I think when it's dinner, people get daunted by, what am I going to cook? Does it have to be all home cooked? And it does not have to be. And I actually kind of went through my own evolution with this. My mom was wonderful, entertaining. Everything was sort of homemade growing up. And I've realized, you know, everything doesn't have to be homemade. I can make one thing that I make and I can bring in other things or ask people to bring things. And it's more important to not be stressed out about how your main course is coming along when people come in the door than greeting them and spending time with them. So we'll spend more time talking about this, but I think we will learn from guests, like, what is that friction and how can we reduce that friction? But really the goal of the brand is to encourage people to just spend the time together and meaningful time. So not just good time, but hard time as well, because life is not all joyful. It's full of difficult things as well. But we get through those things when we're with other people. So there's a lot for us to work on.
Yeah, no, that's great. And actually, one of the reasons why I am so excited about the products I'll be receiving is hearing that they're leather. For me, I've found things like leather, things that patina with use, are so great because it actually enhances the product. And so when I heard that, it's not like the pressure, like, you know, we just got this coffee table and it's like, somebody messes up that coffee table, I'll be pissed. But if it's leather, like, hey, that'll look cool. So
yeah. I agree. It's something you can have over years and can even potentially, like, these are items you can potentially hand down to children or what have you. But also the goal for the brand is to have beautifully executed, very high quality products, but that are not so precious. So they can all go in the dishwasher. Our glassware can go in the dishwasher. Our ceramics can go in the microwave. So we want them to be, like, very, very usable, because I have all of these beautiful, you know, silver and crystal and china from my wedding, and I never use it because it's too hard to take care of. So our objective is to actually create products that are beautiful and super high quality, that you're very, very happy to interact with on a daily basis, but are not so precious that you can't use them on a daily basis.
I'm ready to see. I'm excited about this.
All right.
Great. Sounds good.
Okay. Two more questions. One of the last ones is, do you have one or two top resources, books, websites, courses you can recommend to our listeners? Could be related to financial planning, wealth management, or frankly, just to life.
Yeah, this sounds planned now, but one of the things I like to mention, I guess for me, it's not wealth management stuff, because I think a lot of my time is spent trying to get myself to think about things differently, try new things and read different things. So a website actually that I started using is called the Isolation Journals, and maybe you should do some, like, branding with this. it was started by a woman, Suleika Joed, I believe is the pronunciation, someone with leukemia, an artist, married to an artist, and created the Isolation Journals to provide a place for people to connect during challenging times. Mm-hmm. And so weekly, you get, like, a journal prompt. I don't actually do the journaling, but maybe with my blue goatskin journal, I will. And so at any rate, it's really well written and it's created a community, and it's generally people who are suffering through a hardship. But for me, my wife was diagnosed with an aggressive breast cancer 2 years ago. And so my interest is increased, but it also helps put me in a mental space that's different from my normal day-to-day work. And so for me, it's been a very interesting website, which I've just recently started doing. So I wanted to mention that. I would say that's the primary one. And given the fact that it fits so well into what you're talking about, I'll leave it there.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I think that'll be helpful to a lot of people, and I'm going to definitely check it out. Okay, last question. What do you do for yourself? So I know you've been through a lot with Sabrina. You have children, you're busy dad, you're busy starting your business. Do you have a practice, a focus, a habit, a daily routine you adhere to? Why and what does it do for you?
Yeah, this actually sounds like I may be overindulgent now that I'm saying it out loud. So typically speaking, I get up about an hour and a half. I get up early. I get up about an hour and a half before my household does. And I have that quiet, calm time to get organized, to think about what's going on for the day, just to have some time for myself where I feel like I can think very clearly and organize my thoughts and my day. So that's sort of my prep time. And I need that. It just makes my life or day much smoother if I do that. And then in the evening, I typically take a hot tub, and that helps calm me and center myself as well. So I sort of have these bookmarks at the beginning and end of the days in which I'm trying to create time and space for myself. So those are the primary ones that I execute on and are important for me to find my balance or my focus.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing. Yeah. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And we'll add some information to the show notes so people can get more information. Can you just tell our listeners where they can look you up online?
Sure. RationalIM.com. Feel free to contact me if it's any guidance or in any way I can support you in your financial literacy or goals. I'm happy to do so.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you, Ashley. I'm so excited about this brand. Can't wait to get my samples.
Okay.
See you soon. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining On the Table with Ashley, where we'll meet individuals with thought-provoking perspectives from their varied life experiences and professions. On the Table will cover any topic you or I can put on the table with the goal of increasing curiosity, respect, and understanding while decreasing judgment, even when the issues discussed have sharp and contrasting viewpoints. On the Table also bridges to my company, Âme Attente, which has started with the goal of helping people connect more meaningfully through straightforward, skillfully made, bespoke home goods. Check us out at ametend.com. That's ametendre.com or on Instagram at ametend. And if you have ideas for future podcast episodes, shoot us an email at reachoutanytime@ametend.com. Thanks for listening.